Good afternoon, and welcome to On the Docket. I'm Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center in Central Islip. Every Sunday at this time, we talk about current legal issues and how they affect you. Today, On the Docket, we're talking about an emotional topic, child support and child custody. Here at Toro Law, we know firsthand what families are going through because of our family law clinic. Our students handle pro bono cases that come to us from across Long Island. To help us learn more about the clinic and the types of cases we're seeing, we're joined by Professor Louis Silverman, director of the Toro Family Law Clinic, and Danielle Schwager, a staff attorney at the clinic. Professor Silverman served in the Suffolk County Family Court system for 20 years before joining us at Toro Law Center in 1995. Thank you for being on the show today, Professor Silverman.
My pleasure.
Can you tell us a little bit about the clinic and the services that you provide?
The Family Law Clinic is a live client clinic. People call in, and the students who are interning in the clinic talk to each client. We receive information, and we try to give the client some guidance, some advice, some help in navigating the family court system. For a few clients, depending on the issue, depending on the timing, depending on the circumstances, we may actually accept the client to represent them in Suffolk County Family Court.
So you mentioned family court, and last week on the show we talked about problem-solving courts. I know that family court is different than that, but could you just let us know the kinds of cases generally that family court handles?
Well, family court handles a variety of cases, including child support, child custody, abuse and neglect cases, juvenile delinquency cases, and related types of issues. The clinic primarily deals with child support cases, some child custody and visitation issues, and those are primarily what we do. We occasionally get involved in divorce issues, but rarely.
And is the clinic currently taking clients?
The clinic is taking clients. People can call 631-761-7080, and one of the clinical secretaries will take an intake information, and a student will return the phone call within 2 or 3 days.
And how is it determined the kinds of cases that you're able to handle? Is it based on income? Is it based on need? Is it based on the level of complexity of the case? Is it based on jurisdiction?
It's based on a lot of things. First of all, we try only to handle cases in the Suffolk County Family Court in Central Islip. That's just a logistical issue. Secondly, we try only to, primarily gear our services to people who could not otherwise afford an attorney. And we try and pick those cases where we feel that the client will not be able to fully represent themselves, where there's a special issue or they've had problems in the court before, and they have a point to be made, and the clinic, with the able work of the students and the supervising attorneys, can make that case for them.
Right. So you were telling me before the show that there are three questions or issues that you hear a lot at the clinic when people call. I'll get this right. How do I get my ex to pay? What if I can't afford to pay? And how do I get custody? So maybe let's take the first one. How do I get my ex to pay? Let's walk through some of the problems and tell people what they need to do or know.
Okay. Well, how do you get your ex to pay? Not always an easy thing. If your ex is working and working on the books, it's real easy because the state will take care of it for you by simply issuing an income withholding order. If your ex is not, then it becomes a little more difficult. The first thing you have to do is make sure that the order is payable through the support collection unit, because the support collection unit has a lot of administrative remedies. They can enforce the order. If you have to go to family court, you can always get a judgment for arrears. Judgments last for 20 years, and they serve as liens on property. Someone hits the lottery, they check with the court first to make sure, before they pay out the money, that there are no arrears. The court can also issue lump sum payments, And the court can occasionally incarcerate someone for not paying support. But I have to say, incarceration is a rarely used remedy because this is civil contempt, not criminal contempt. The judges don't like to do it. And the whole point of incarceration is to get money out of someone who has it in their pocket. Sometimes it works. I've seen people when the judge says, okay, $2,500, you're going to jail for 60 days, they pull the money out of their pocket. But I also want to say one other thing. When it gets to enforcement of child support, the custodial parent does not have the burden to prove that the other parent can pay. The non-custodial parent actually has the legal burden to prove that he or she can't pay. And that helps navigate through the system. The remedies are only as good as the money that may be available. We sometimes say you can't get blood out of a stone, and you can't always get money out of someone who just is recalcitrant and doesn't want to pay. The judges and support magistrates can't actually ask them to empty their pockets in the courtroom, although sometimes it might be a good idea.
So in terms of the amount of payments, that's set by state statute. It's not something that's negotiable, or is it negotiable?
No, it's negotiable. The statute is there. The statute is the presumption. The parties are free to change it, but the enforcement problem happens after the amount is set and someone decides they really don't want to pay.
So there's a difference between they don't want to pay and they can't afford to pay. How does a court make a determination what somebody can afford to pay? Is it putting in your paycheck stubs or any kind of benefit stubs that you get or your bank account information?
It's presenting proof, presenting your income, presenting your expenses. If your expenses exceed your income, the court always wants to know how you're meeting those expenses. If you claim some kind of injury or disability, you have to present proof, medical records or some kind of other proof. If you don't have any other excuse and simply say, for instance, I've lost my job and I can't find another one, well, then you have to show the court that you are actively seeking employment, and employment that's commensurate with your skills and your ability and your previous job. And it becomes a hearing, and the magistrate will then listen to all the evidence and make a determination.
Mm-hmm. And so I assume that this is a highly emotionally charged issue. Are there social workers, are there counselors, are other people involved with either the clinic or when people get into family court to help try to reach a happier resolution to these issues?
Generally in family court, no. Family court is a place which is for the uninitiated, it can be very unpleasant. There's not a lot of help given, especially to self-represented litigants. In the clinic, we are professionals and we try to negotiate with the other side if we can. If they have a lawyer, we talk to the lawyer. If it's a self-represented litigant, we will try to negotiate a settlement without taking advantage of anybody because they don't have an attorney. But it's one of these things where generally you sometimes just have to get the people in the same place and try and get them to talk to each other. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
So the clinic focuses a lot on these support issues. And you said sometimes you deal with divorces, although not all the time. Aren't custody battles and the support battles tied up with the divorce proceedings?
Well, they are, but because of our bifurcated court system where family court and Supreme Court have overlapping but not identical jurisdiction, more support and custody is actually done in family court than Supreme Court. Also, people who were not married to each other, they all go to family court. So the bulk of the cases are done in family court. Family court also doesn't have filing fees. So for the self-represented litigant, they can afford to at least get in the door in family court, whereas Supreme Court, of course, a few hundred dollars in filing fees.
Right. So do you have any advice for people that are in a situation where it's irreconcilable and they're going to seek legal counsel, what kinds of documentation should they bring with them?
Well, they should bring proof of anything they have. They should bring pay stubs. They should bring tax returns. We will ask people to fill out a what's called the net worth statement, which is a statement of their income and their expenses. If there have been police reports, they should bring police reports. If there have been any other court orders, a lot of people who contact the clinic have already been to court, and we want to see the previous orders. We want to see what's gone on before. If they've lost their job, bring proof. If they have a medical issue, bring some kind of documentation.
Great. So the number again for the Toro Law Family Law Clinic is
631-761-7080.
Thank you very much, Professor Silverman. Coming up, we'll continue our discussion with both Professor Silverman and Danielle Schwager regarding child custody. Please stay with us. You're listening to On the Docket with Dean Patricia Salkin of Toro Law Center on Long Island News 103.9. Welcome back to On the Docket. I'm Patricia Salkin, Dean of Toro Law Center in Central Islip, and I'm here with Professor Silverman, Director of the Toro Family Law Clinic, and we're happy to be joined by Danielle Schwager. Danielle is the staff attorney at the Toro Law Family Clinic. In this capacity, she helps students prepare to appear in Suffolk County Family Court. She's a former assistant district attorney for Suffolk County and now has a private practice with an emphasis on family law. Welcome, Danielle.
Thank you.
So you heard I was just talking to Professor Silverman about child support, but at the clinic, you get a lot of questions on child custody as well. And I was wondering if you could share the kinds of questions that you see.
The question that I get asked most often and that we hear most often is, can I get sole custody of my children? Most people don't understand what sole custody is, and there actually are more than one option. When they ask that question, what they're really asking is, I want my kids to live with me. And the answer is yes, and you don't need sole custody to do that. What most cases are resolved by is joint custody, which leaves both parents the ability to make decisions regarding their children, with residential custody to one of the parents. So once that's explained, that usually eases a lot of the fears.
So people confuse sole custody with who the child is going to reside with, as opposed to the legal semantics. You know, both parents would want to have the joint custody to help get medical attention and to help talk to the teachers in school and so forth.
Correct. One of the other concerns that a lot of parents have in today's day and age is international travel with their children. And they think that the only way they can secure their child not being removed from the country is by sole custody. However, since 9/11, the United States has put in place very strict guidelines for children being removed from the country. So for the most part, those concerns really can be alleviated by explaining that to both parents.
So are there, we talked about support before, are there financial or support implications with respect to custody?
The court will look at financial ability. However, that is not by any means at the top of the list for consideration as to which of the parents will be granted physical custody of the children. It is a factor, but not the sole factor.
But there's a belief that the parent that gets the physical or the residential custody more than 50% of the time, that the other parent may have to pay more in support. How does that work out?
One of the newer trends in settling cases now is what's called shared custody, a 50-50 split, give or take a few minutes or two. And there are people who literally sit down and count the hours and the days and the minutes that they are proposed to share with their children. What most people don't realize is 50-50 doesn't get anybody out of child support. Whichever parent makes more money will end up with a child support order, unless the parties agree to waive the child support requirement.
So what are some of the factors that the courts will look at when they're deciding custody issues?
One of the most important factors the courts look at is which parent will foster the relationship between the children and the non-custodial parent. After that come several things, such as do either of the parents have a drug and alcohol problem? Is there a child protective services, a neglect or abuse history with either or both of the parents? Mental health issues? Are one of the parents a registered sex offender? Criminal history, convicted criminal history, things of that nature.
And so the legal standard is, I think, best interests of the child is what the courts will try to look at.
That is indeed what they look at. In most cases where custody is at issue, the children themselves will be appointed an attorney to represent their interests, which is a new concept to parents, which usually has to be explained to them that, yes, your minor child also gets an attorney who will speak for them.
Right, because parents typically go and get their own legal counsel, and they don't realize that somebody else is going to be representing their children's interests, and it's not them.
That is correct. And attendant with, you know, their children receiving their own counsel, you will also have to look out for the manipulation of the children, particularly depending on what ages they're at. And parents trying to influence the children and use their attorney to do their bidding.
And so what kinds of things would the attorney, are they guardians or attorneys that are appointed for the children? What would they look at and who would they talk to?
The attorneys for the children are, they speak with their clients, with the children. Of course, as long as they're speaking age. We represent attorneys for children
with
represent
the parents
children.
Present or not present?
Not present. Mm-hmm. Attorney-client privilege does attach to that relationship. It's the exact same relationship that adults have with attorneys. And explaining to parents that they are not permitted nor welcome to come into the session is not always easy for them to grasp. Mm-hmm. Understandably so. And once in a while, the interview has to be stopped to address that with the court so that the parent understands how that works.
So the parents don't realize often that they're dragging their kids into the middle, front, and center of a legal proceeding. It's not just about them. They're actively involved.
That is correct. And, you know, it's a shame because a couple's divorce is also very traumatic for the children. A lot of parents don't realize that. You know, their parents aren't living together anymore, and then they don't understand what's going on, and everything obviously is dependent on the age of the children. And sometimes it's actually more traumatic for the older children, the teenage children, because they are aware and they do understand what's going on.
So what advice do you have for parents who are going through a divorce?
Leave the kids out of it. And perhaps that's, you know, number one on the dream hit list, because it is most definitely easier said than done. But, you know, parents should not discuss the finances with the children or complain about the other parent not paying certain things or that it's anybody's fault for that happening. You know, parents should understand that it doesn't matter if you live in a 10-story building and you're in the basement and the kids are on the 10th floor. They hear everything. Parents are absolutely entitled to vent and yell and scream and cry and, you know, complain to their friends, just not when the children are anywhere around, because they have eagle ears. They hear it all and they internalize it.
Mm-hmm. That's good advice, but I'm sure very hard to follow in a situation that's already incredibly emotionally charged.
Emotion is definitely the driving force behind divorces. Mm-hmm. A marriage in and of itself is a contract, and a divorce is the cessation, the ending of that contract, which in and of itself isn't really difficult to do, except emotions are what drive the divorce. And drive the inability sometimes to resolve it in a quick fashion. So sometimes we have to let a case, as we say, stew for a little while. Mm-hmm. Let people kind of work through, you know, their emotions and through the fact that they are getting divorced. Quite often, one party wants the divorce and the other side vehemently does not want to get divorced.
Is a court required to place the child or children with one of the two parents, or can there be situations where the parents are both misbehaving or both found to be non-fit at a given point in time?
Sometimes we wish there was another alternative for the children. Only in the rarest of circumstances would children not be placed with either of their biological parents. And if that's happening, it's usually through a family court neglect or abuse proceeding.
Right.
So sometimes it is the lesser of the evils. But, you know, these are the parents that the children have, and that's the situation they're going to have to function through.
And so when the children speak with their attorney, are they also required to show up in court, or does the attorney speak for them and represent them while they're in school or someplace else?
The children are absolutely not required to appear in court, nor should they be brought to court. We try to shield the children from the proceedings as much as is humanly possible. Their attorney will speak for them and on their behalf, and for the children who are old enough to understand whatever will be said to the judge, they will be aware of.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be with their consent and understanding.
And so any advice, lastly, for the parents in terms of what they should tell their children about the divorce and about the custody issues? You said they shouldn't talk about finances and they shouldn't talk about the other parent, but somebody should be speaking to the children to give them reassurances.
I always, and attorneys for children, always advise the parents to explain to them that, just to tell their children that there's going to be somebody looking out for you, and just speak the truth, and that everything will be okay after that. Parents really shouldn't discuss the court proceedings. That's what their attorney will explain to them. And really just keep the children out of it and shield them from the proceedings.
And reinforce that they're loved.
Yes. I like to tell the parents that when parents speak badly about the other parent to children, it's really telling the children that there's half of them they don't love.
Right.
Because a child is both half of each parent.
So the number for the Toro Law Family Law Clinic is 631-761-7080. I want to thank Danielle Schwager and Professor Lewis Silverman for your illuminating thoughts and commentary on this important topic. It was really wonderful to have both of you on the show, and I'd like to thank everybody out there for listening. We'll be back on Long Island News 103.9 next Sunday at 4:30 p.m. with another great episode of On the Docket. Until then, this is Toro Law Dean Patricia Salkin wishing you a good week.